NetCredit is here to say yes to a personal loan or line of credit when other lenders say no. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partner. NetCredit, credit to the people.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing and rating. Really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be talking about large predators, because over the past couple of months, people across Europe, presumably frustrated with lack of biodiversity or the fact that their politicians aren't motivated by the sort of idea of how they would like their world to be, people have taken the idea of rewilding into their own hands. And we've seen rogue introduction of wild lynx and even some wild boar into living landscapes. We're going to be talking to Johnny Hansen about whether or not that's a good idea and why, whether or not we might see something like that here in Ireland in a bit. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at @newstalkscience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the podcast. Before we go into news round, just a reminder that if you are looking to use AI to reduce the amount of time you spend on stuff you don't like doing, I've set up a program called Get Started with AI, and you can learn the skills to cut hours out of your working week. Find out more at getstartedai.com. All right, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining us in studio is Dr. Annie Curtis from RCSI and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Annie, our first story has to do with bone marrow.
It does. Well, it actually has to do with treatment of sickle cell disease. So, and what they found is that there is a new bone marrow transplant method that has just been developed that really could be transformative in terms of, you know, changing the lives of people with this disease. So what is sickle cell? So sickle cell, it's a genetic condition. So you inherit it from your mom and your dad. And it actually affects about 20 to 25 million people globally. A lot, there's a very high percentage in Africa. And it's a very painful condition. So what happens is there's loss of function of a gene, hemoglobin, in your red blood cells. And this causes the red blood cells, instead of being lovely and round, kind of like Smarties, maybe, would you say? They kind of become like stiff and crescent shaped. And that's the real characteristic of sickle cell. And because of that, those red blood cells can't carry oxygen to the same way as like wild type cells. And this can cause, you know, severe damage and blockages in blood vessels.
Where is this research from?
So this research is actually from John Hopkins, the Kimmel Cancer Center. And the paper was actually published. It's the New England Journal of Medicine Evidence, which I actually had to look up because I wasn't sure whether there was a New England Journal of Medicine Evidence, but there is. So we have the New England Journal that many people will have heard of.
So wait, is there like a New England Journal of, we're just having a pretty good guess?
Yeah,
like aren't all of the journals evidence-based?
Well, this is medicine evidence, so
right, okay.
That is quirky, I thought. But anyway, that is where the paper is published, and it is quite a good journal. And the reason why this is so, I suppose, transformative is that many people would think that in order to have a bone marrow transplant, really for anything, you have to have like a very identical match.
Yeah.
So, but what this technique has done, it's called reduced intensity haploidentical bone marrow transplantation. You don't need a perfectly matched donor. You can have a half matched donor. So that could be somebody related to the patient, even as far out as a cousin. And another factor of this treatment that makes it better than what else is out there is that you don't have to have as much chemotherapy, you don't have to have as many transfusions. Because interestingly, there was, you know, a big deal made back in 2023 because gene therapy for sickle cell disease came out. So though there's two therapies there that are available. But, you know, when you look at the cost, so the cost for gene therapy for per patient for sickle cell disease is between 2 to 3 million, whereas for this bone marrow transplantation, it's $500,000. And this is something, you know, like I, you know, even when I lecture to undergraduates, you know, I'm talking a lot now about the cost of these treatments that we are developing. Like if you think about CAR T cell therapy, any of the immunotherapies, that, you know, these are really expensive treatments that we're developing. So
and developing countries, you know, where this is obviously
Think of Africa, this would not be available.
Yeah.
So you know, in terms of, you know, both cost, both effect on the patient, this seems to be a win-win.
When it comes to the bone marrow, is it the stem cells they're taking out or what is it?
Yeah, so they'll take out the stem cells. So for the gene therapy, what they do is they take out the stem cells and they do that genetic manipulation and they put those manipulated stem cells back into the patient. Then for the bone marrow transplantation, then what they do is they do high dose chemotherapy and irradiation, you know.
That's to sort of almost kill all the bad cells.
And then get the stem cells and put those back in.
Very cool. All right. Our second story, Shane, has to do with Mars, a planet that we haven't talked about in quite some time, actually. It's sort of been, it's dropped off the horizon in a way.
It has. Well, Mars is back with a bang. It is the planet of the year 2025. You heard it here. And there are two stories that I came across this week about Mars. The first one is something I would have assumed had been answered a long time ago, which is why is Mars red? And I would have just thought they knew there was a load of iron on Mars. But no. And in a great case of nominative determinism, scientists at Brown University have determined why Mars is red. They looked at data from the Martian orbiters, things in orbit. They looked at data from the rovers, the little cars on the ground. And they did a huge amount of experiments, computational and otherwise, back here on Earth. And they had long thought that there was that Mars is red because of something called hematite, which is an iron oxide, right? Mm. And iron would be associated with this kind of a rusty colour. But now they know that it's actually a different iron-rich mineral, one called ferrihydrite. It's kind of similar, but what we know about ferrihydrite is that it had to be made in the presence of water and a lot of water.
Ah.
So now we're able to tell that the dust on Mars that gives it its very famous red hue is because of a process that took place in a very water-rich environment.
A very water-rich, which actually is quite exciting because obviously we always talk about water being one of the basic requirements for life, and Mars, the question over whether or not there was an abundance of water has always been there because it's such a close planet, we might be able to find life. Hence all of the obsession with it and getting there. This is good news. And I thought I saw a headline during the week about beaches on Mars?
This is the other story to do with water and indeed life on Mars. So sandy beaches have been discovered by the Chinese rover called Zhurong, which just landed there a little while back. Of course, there are lots of American rovers there at the moment, like Perseverance, etc. But this is the Chinese rover, and it used underground radar to look at the sediments under the ground. And they're able to tell basically regions that they know would have been shorelines, the kind of the boundaries between oceans, which we weren't fully sure they were there. We knew there were rivers on Mars, but not really sure whether there were oceans. Now we know that the most likely was, and not only would there have been oceans, there would have been waves, there would have been tides, there would have been rivers flowing into the oceans. And this is all because of the sediment that they found and the gradient of the sediment. This is 3.6 billion years ago at a time when life was starting on Earth. We've ruled out other causes, and what's known on Earth is that life would have been more easily formed in these intermediary zones where land and ocean meet. And so if life started potentially on Earth in a region like that, would it have also started in a place like Mars?
Amazing. I think at some point we'll get samples back from Mars, right? It's still
that's the end.
Yet.
It's basically saying we need to get these rocks back. We haven't even planned the mission to go and collect them, but we're still able to do.
As I've always said, like, do that first. But everyone's like, no, you can't do it that way. And scientists always get cross at me when they say, you can't do that. We've got to do this first and see if it. I said, just grab a bit of Mars and then head back. Now, obviously, heading back is technically difficult. But like the skipping over that, yada, yada, yada. And then we know if there was life.
But I like your ambition, John.
Yada, yada, yada. Yeah. Right. Our third story has to do with seagulls.
Yes.
Oh, God. I hate seagulls.
Well,
the rats of the sky.
I love hate relationship with seagulls. And I think any of us who live in Dublin, especially, you know, going around St. Stephen's Green, we see the array of seagulls. And this is about seagulls and their feeding habits, which I am interested in because I have to tell you a story. You know the Green Bench Cafe, you know that like up the road on and just off Dawson, not on Dawson Street, just up from here anyway. Really nice sandwiches. You get a really nice like beef, hot beef sandwich. And I had bought one of those, brought it down to St. Stephen's Green. And a seagull, as I was chatting to a friend, came along and just took out the beef.
Selectively?
Yeah.
Oh, well, at least it didn't take the whole sandwich.
I know, but it's not much of a beef sandwich without the beef.
Would you eat the remainder?
I think people are way too fussy. I really do.
Oh,
I think people would
lick it off the ground, to be honest with you.
I think people are way, it's touched the ground. Yeah. Oh, someone touched it with their hand. Get over
your
yourself.
System.
Someone touched my hair, like, and then they used that for food. Like, come on. You know, when I was growing up, there wasn't as much sensitivity to the world.
Day.
Yeah, I've turned into George Hook. I've George Hook-ified myself.
But so what this story is about is that they've started the citizen science project that people can take pictures of when they see seagulls eating certain things. Because we actually have very little data to understand why seagulls eat what they're eating and why they're changing their habitats, you know, going from...
Do they choose what they eat?
Well, as in, like, if there's not enough food, the problem at the moment is with climate change, etc., there's not enough food around the coastal regions. So that's why they come into the urban regions, is to actually feed. And sometimes they'll just be in the urban regions, you know, after they've had their chicks and they're feeding their chicks. And then when their chicks have left the nest, they'll go back to the coastal regions. So I just think this is a lovely citizen science project for all around the world, where people can take a snap when they see a seagull eating something. They upload it onto this website. I checked the website and there's already a couple of entries from Ireland, one from County Wexford, two from County Cork, and then a number then from the UK, because the researcher, she's an ecologist from the University of Salford, Dr. Risley. So she set up this project and she just would ask for people to, you know, submit their entries. And I think it's just a really nice way for them to gather data and really understand what they're eating at certain times of year, you know, when the climate is a certain way, etc.
Chips, mostly. Right?
I can just imagine all these teenagers
hot beef sandwich
in the Stephen's Green in little huts, just like waiting for people, like maybe kind of setting up scenarios where seagulls are going to take people's food and then putting it on, you know, online.
Do you know what my kids do? My kids go to Stephen's Green and they get porridge and they put it on their shoulder and like all of the pigeons land on their shoulder. And I'm like, I'm not very cool with this. I mean, not great idea in the season of avian flu. Not the best idea, but...
But actually, there's evidence that seagulls will eat pigeons.
Wow. Oh, there you go. That'd be a good photo. our final story, Shane, has to do with the asteroid that never was.
Yeah, like I heard so much about this asteroid, 2024 YR4. And that was first spotted on the 27th of December last year. And we were told it wasn't an insignificant probability that it would hit the Earth.
It went up to 2%. That's pretty significant.
3.1%, in fact, in 2032. Yeah, but now, because of science, we have been able to determine its trajectory more accurately. And it has gone from 3.1% down to 0.0017%. So it's 1,800 times less likely to hit the Earth. A 1 in 59,000 chance that it'll hit the Earth.
But Shane, could that change again?
Unlikely, because they only spotted it for the first time the 27th of December, and the folks at the Jet Propulsion Lab at NASA would have gotten an awful lot more data to understand the trajectory it was going to go and map out where it would go. I trust them that they know what they're doing there, but it's unfortunately more likely now to hit the moon.
Can I just say, actually, I want to follow up on that. I don't know what's wrong with me, and maybe it's just everything that's going on in the news at the moment, but when I heard this story that it went from 3%, 1 in 33, down to 0.00, I was very disappointed.
You were disappointed?
That the asteroid wasn't going to smash into Earth. That's how lacking in stimulation my life appears to be. That I was like, oh, I was hoping that I might hit something.
Did you have anything in mind?
There's a certain postcode in the United States that if it hit there, like, you know.
But Shane,
I genuinely was obsessed.
Like, would it just, if it had hit?
Well, this was another thing. And I ended up going down a rabbit hole on Wikipedia understanding about how asteroids hit. And there are various different scales that are there to assess the danger. This one was most likely to hit at mid-latitudes around the equator and would have done so in a more gradual way than just smack into the side. It was big, but it isn't big enough to have caused an extinction event.
But pretty big though. It would take out a city.
About 100 metres wide, up to 100 metres wide. So big enough to cause significant damage, but not big enough to... We're doing it ourselves, causing our own extinction, right?
But yeah, who cares? But the moon... bigger impact on the moon, right? Well, I mean, like, you're talking about something like that, hitting it, could it snooker ball the moon out of orbit?
No, because unfortunately not. But
I hate this asteroid. This is so disappointing.
It would certainly move the moon. It would nudge it. But
would,
like,
it really?
Yeah, but the moon is already leaving us at the rate your fingernails grow every year. So it's like... That's,
would that not affect the tides, though, if it nudged it?
Tiny amounts. But the moon gets bombarded with asteroids all the time. Remember the dark side of the far side of the moon when you see the pictures of it? Yeah. It is quite potted.
But this is a big one. If it hit the moon, yeah, just at the right angle.
I wonder where we see it. That could be fun.
There's a great book called If, I think it's by Randall Munroe, and he goes into, he's an amazing science communicator and cartoonist, right? Mm. XKCD is the comic he does. Very funny. And he does a lot of what happened, what would happen if, and he does lots of bits around the moon, and what if the moon just disappeared? Okay. And we would be gone without that moon. We need that moon so badly. Right, Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Annie Curtis, thanks very much for joining us. Now, while the idea of reintroducing large carnivores like wolves and lynx back into the wild has been floated many times in the past, what impact would that actually have on the environment? And what more do we need to do to convince people it might be a good idea? Well, Dr. Johnny Hansen is research fellow at Queen's University Belfast and author of Living with Lynx, Sharing Landscapes with Big Cats, Wolves and Bears. He joins me now to discuss. Welcome to the programme, Johnny. One of the reasons we wanted to have you on is because there's been a few stories over the last while of people sort of rogue rewilding animals because they feel like it's a good idea and they just... have just been releasing like boars and a few other animals into the wild across Europe.
Yeah, not just across Europe, Jonathan. It's good to be on the show and talking about this topic, which is very live because at the start of this year in Scotland, we had illegal releases of 4 Eurasian lynx. So this wild cat about the size of a Labrador dog. And then more recently, wild boar as well. And they're often called gorilla releases because there's some fairly shady shenanigans going on. And one of my concerns about that is that in people taking the law into their own hands and doing it illegally, they're driving a bulldozer through the trust that was being built up in the legal process. Because while we're talking about wild species like lynx and wolves and all of that, the actual act of us bringing them back to Ireland or to Scotland, say, it's something done by people. So it's about human relationships as well as our relationship with nature.
Absolutely. Tell us first, maybe, why we would benefit or if we would benefit from the reintroduction of apex predators in Ireland, for example.
Yeah, there's 3 main parts of the case for, and the first is the ecology of it. And there's something just quite profound and powerful that apex predators contribute when they're in an ecosystem at the top of their food chain. It's called the science of trophic cascades. So even though they're small in number, they have this outsized impact on all the layers of the web of life beneath them, all the way down to plant communities at the base. And we can try to replicate that through hunting, say, but we can't quite do it as well as apex predators do. And when we see those species returning to landscapes, it's good for nature and it helps nature to recover and flourish. It's just a really important link in the chain of the circle of life that is missing from our landscapes on this island. The other big part of the case for is there's a really strong case in terms of the tourism that people would pay, and in places like Yellowstone, people pay significant amounts of money. Tens of millions of dollars are generated annually in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem by wolf and bear tourism. So there's quite a strong economic case in terms of the tourism benefits. And then there's just, aside from those elements, there's the wonder that comes from being in a landscape when animals like this are around. It's just, it adds something that we can't quite put our finger on it, but it makes landscapes more exciting.
I was lucky enough to go to the Yellowstone in a series that I produced where I met Doug, one of the gentlemen involved in reintroducing the wolf. And the story sort of, I didn't break the story, but the story was that the wolf being reintroduced to Yellowstone had a dramatic effect on the ecosystem. And I felt like my radar sort of started tingling after I'd, you know, put out the story. It sounded too good to be true. And now that it's a couple of years between me and that documentary, I'm wondering, has the science actually borne out the claims that you know, sort of spread across the internet that we reintroduce wolves and they'll have a dramatic effect on the environment? or was that a neatly packaged story because it just the media just loved it and it it took off like in a viral way? Like, when we do this, do we actually see those sort of benefits? Because the claims are quite high.
It's a great question. And in relation to Yellowstone, which is the poster child for large carnivore reintroduction across the world, and even here on the other side of the Atlantic, we're having this conversation in part because of what happened in Yellowstone and how it was communicated, because you're absolutely right. The science is more nuanced. And I went to Yellowstone with a wolf ecologist as a fully paid up believer in what's called the Wolves Change Rivers thesis, which is that wolves alone were responsible for this ecological renewal. And what I discovered and what the science backs up is that it is a bit more complex. Wolves were but one factor. For instance, beavers were reintroduced around the same time. They were moving into the park and bringing about changes. And then there's things like fire and climate that are always active in the mix of factors shaping landscapes and ecosystems. So absolutely, the science is more nuanced. And when we see that science translated to European landscapes, some of those effects are not quite the same, even as we saw in Yellowstone. And that's partly because the landscapes are not as wild. We have farming and traffic and all of our human activities and invasive species, for example, in Ireland, lots of sika deer. So absolutely a really strong case for ecological benefits. But lynx or wolves alone are not going to solve the nature crisis. So we need to have that degree of nuance there that you've pointed out, which is really key.
When we look at these sort of landscapes, they don't really transfer very well onto Ireland, do they? I mean, Owen Dalton has, you know, made a big campaign over kind of identifying something that I hadn't really thought about before, the sort of barrenness of all of our wild spaces due to overgrazing of sheep and lack of containment of cattle for agriculture. And I guess one of the questions that I wanted to ask you is, I mean, do we even have a landscape to reintroduce lynx and wolves to? Ireland is so small, it's been parceled up into agricultural land. Where would these animals go if not on private land that is there for animals that these animals would eat?
Yeah, at the moment, and particularly with lynx, who are forest specialists and forest dwellers, some studies by work by Colin Guilfoyle has said that we just don't have the forest cover currently to have a healthy population of lynx over 100 years, which is the standard measure for a population surviving. Wolves are a bit less picky about habitat. They can kind of go anywhere. And some work by Killian Murphy has looked at that in relation to four national parks in Ireland. But as you've pointed out, wolves and lynx too travel outside of those national parks. They travel into private lands where there are farming communities and livestock. And that's where a lot of the challenges come. And that's my particular interest, is how do people share landscapes when we have livestock and tourism and hunting and forestry with these animals that sometimes get in the way of the way we want a landscape to be. But we are also conditioned, because we've watched so many documentaries about Yellowstone and the Serengeti, that large carnivores belong over there, and we as humans belong over here. Whereas if we look at most of human history and much of the world as it is today, we find spaces in between, the really wild and the really domestic, where we share landscapes. And there's a really interesting example from the Netherlands, which is half the size of Ireland, with three times the population. And the Netherlands has 100 wolves in 11 packs. 40 plus wolf pups were born last year. So there's a conceptual issue here of what we're willing to accept as wild and where we're willing to accept as wild enough for these species to potentially return.
Yeah. I mean, I've spent a lot of my working life and personal life trying to get to these spaces to observe these animals in the natural habitat. And it is a wonderful and extraordinarily privileged thing to be able to do. The idea that you might go out to an Irish landscape and spot a wolf is to me very exciting. But of course, the flip side of that might be a farmer who has sheep who can't feed their family or are struggling to because of all of the things that we hear about on News Talk and other channels every single week. Is there a model that works out there that says, you know, we'll reintroduce these wolves, and if you get a sheep or two killed by these wolves, we'll pay you for the sheep? Or what is the model to reintroduce a lynx or a wolf to the Irish landscape and keep people and livestock happy?
Much like yourself, Jonathan, I love the idea in principle. In practice, it is complicated. It's complicated in terms of the mechanisms for us to share landscapes, and particularly for livestock farmers and especially sheep farmers to share landscapes with these animals. It's not technically impossible, but it is complex and contested, and it's likely to be costly. And it's not costly so much as it doesn't cost a great deal of money to compensate twice the market rate of a lost sheep. But once you start getting into training farmers to farm differently, fence differently, keep livestock guardian dogs or llamas or donkeys to deter lynx or wolves, those sorts of things, you're getting into paying for human labor, extension agents, people like me training those extension agents, and the bill can start to mount quite quickly. There's some really good examples from Colorado at the moment where wolves have been reintroduced, where they're trying to do things better and do things differently. But on my travels, one of the things that I've taken away and I'm now recommending in my book and report is that we need to have, and what I would like to see, are coexistence trust funds created for landscapes so that the money to make sure that this is done well and that the funding and the management and the governance is adequately funded, not just over the 5 years of a pilot, which is easy to do, but over 50 to 100 years that these species are going to be spreading through our landscapes.
Is it difficult to have the job that you have where you have a vision of what this island should look like? You probably have a reasonable idea of how we might achieve that, but advocating for change, for biodiversity, for reintroduction of species that might help our ecosystem is like shouting into the wind.
Well, my own journey on this over the last 10 years, and also seeing examples of it now in the last few years on my travels for this book and report, which have taken me all across Western Europe and North America, is that while I continue to absolutely love the idea and principle, the more I have looked into this, the more challenging and complex that I have come to believe that it is. And I came to it as a snow leopard conservationist who specializes in how do snow leopards share landscape with farmers in Nepal. When these species return to landscapes after long periods, it's really tricky. When they do so after long periods because people bring them back, which is how it would happen in Ireland, it becomes more tricky still.
Why is it trickier when people bring it back as opposed to when they naturally migrate to a place they once were?
I think we don't like change, but it also transforms it from a natural process, something called a recolonization. So wolves have returned to the Netherlands because they walked over the border from Germany, but wolves will only return to Ireland or lynx because we bring them back. Mm. That makes it a social process. It makes it a political process. It makes it a psychological process. And these animals particularly are political animals, as are we as human beings. So there's a lot of politics here. And for me, while ecology remains the strongest part of the argument, the politics of this is really weak. And we saw that in Scotland a couple of weeks ago when a few weeks after the illegal release of lynx, the Scottish First Minister just put a red pen through the whole idea while the SNP are currently in power. So significant political risks. That said, I think in the coming decades, we will see more people wanting this to happen. I will think we will see more afforestation in upland areas and deer filling those landscapes, less sheep, less cattle. So I think in the future, whenever that may be, we will be creating the landscapes that are ideal and the situation that is ideal for the return of these species. And I would like to see now us having really engaged and informed conversations about future-proofing this. And that's why I've written this book.
Yeah. Look, I wish I could share your optimism. I would love to think that the Irish electorate were engaged enough with the natural world that they would see how important it is to have biodiversity around us, to rein back the grazing that we allow, and to return our country in some small part to a wilderness. But I just don't see that happening, unfortunately. What about less contentious species? Are there other species that are perhaps not apex predators, but species that lived in Ireland before that could increase biodiversity? Or are apex predators really the ones that have a significant impact on an ecosystem?
Apex predators do have quite a special role. You could potentially consider something like wildcats, but they tend to hybridize a lot with domestic cats, and that would pose a lot of problems. I think we've seen a lot of benefits from pine martens returning, and also in terms of controlling gray squirrels, that's a really good model to look to. But there is a difference between a pine marten, small pine marten, and a 20 kg lynx or a 40 kg wolf. And in all of this, with the reintroductions, as you've hinted at, and as I've come to believe as an environmental social scientist, The nature bit is the easy bit in many ways. The really tricky bit, Jonathan,
is the people.
Is the human.
Yeah.
It's the human nature.
Yeah. You know, on this program, we cover so many different topics, but every once in a while we come across one of these ones where you just kind of lament where we are versus where we could be when it comes to a rich biodiverse island. I also understand that these animals can be dangerous and, you know, there are risks involved. I presume bears are definitely out in our plan of reintroduction. Bears are probably bad to introduce first.
Bears, yes, are a whole different ballgame. They give me pause for thought. I spend a bit of time in Wyoming being trained how to use bear spray, and you have so little time. They have this, and there's a chapter in the book when I'm charged by RoboBear, which is this radio-controlled bear, plastic bear on top of an electric vehicle, and you've got 3 seconds. And 3 seconds passes so quickly.
Wow.
So bears are a whole different ballgame. But with lynx, virtually no risk to people. With wolves, a little bit more risk to people. But when we put that in the context of the risk we face from our driving or walking down the road, cattle, XL bullies, you know, lightning strikes, all of those things actually pose more risk to us.
Yeah,
and with predators, Jonathan, perception is reality.
Yeah, I totally agree. By the way, if you were ever interested in visiting America, although now is not a particularly great time, Yellowstone is by far one of the most extraordinary places I've been to my entire life. Highly recommend you spend a week there because it has so much to offer. Dr. Johnny Hansen, author of Living with Lynx, Sharing Landscapes with Big Cats, Wolves and Bears, an environmental social scientist. Fascinating speaking with you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week. Peter, via email, says, huge fan of the show, regular listener for years. Lovely to hear that, Peter. Thank you. I am wondering if you have any podcasts covering how fake news or propaganda or general anti-science sentiment has affected people and if there are any proven ways to combat it. Keep up the good work. You know, our own Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD, who you heard in the news round, he actually has a podcast on this called The Trust Race. And if you have a look in your, wherever you get your podcast, you can have a look for that. It's an issue that I think obviously is becoming more and more problematic as AI becomes more and more convincing. You saw Trump and Elon Musk a bunch of times over the past couple of months sharing what had clearly been AI photographs as if they were a real story. So it's a huge problem. Maybe it's something we should revisit on the show, Maurice. But no plans to do that just yet. We'll let you know. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Maurice O'Sullivan, Rory Galvin and Hugo De Silva on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.